This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, two Christmas stories on tap. Also, a political science professor says fewer people are deciding who runs the province these days. We have a report to straighten out how people are getting their water bills. There are some kids in the community who are asking for some very basic things for Christmas. A bank in downtown Sydney is bustling more than usual after some recent closures, and some strikers were making some noise just across the street from the bank, but for a different reason. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Dozens of striking Canadian Union of Postal Workers gathered for a rally outside the post office on Charlotte Street Friday. Canada Post and the union representing more than 55,000 striking workers appear closer, though, to resuming negotiations as the strike enters the fourth week. Cecilia O'Neill is the Breton Local 117 vice president. She says it seems the public is on their side.
Oh, the rally was great. We had a lot of support from the people, and just having us all together, letting people know that we want to be back to work. The response from the public has been great. They understand that we're not just here for us, we're here for all of Canada and all labor relations departments.
Local 117 has 180 members. She says her group has been anxious to return to work for weeks, and there are many people who are inconvenienced, who normally ship presents over the holidays.
Well, we're starting week four. We hoped we weren't here. We want to get back to work. We're having this rally today to show the public that we do want to be back out there. We want to get their Christmas presents and their Santa Claus letters delivered.
Calls for federal government intervention in the strike have been mounting from the business community, but so far the government has said it is not stepping in. O'Neill says residents on the outskirts of larger cities and towns are also feeling the impact.
The inconvenience for small businesses are being affected the most, and also rural communities that don't have access to other people delivering.
Federal mediation was put on hold last week because Canada Post and the union were too far apart at the bargaining table. But this week, Canada Post says it's reviewing new counterproposals, although specifics haven't been released by either side. O'Neill mentions some of the items they are dealing with.
So right now, it's more than wages and benefits. It's about fairness, dignity, and protecting a public service that millions of Canadians rely on daily. Postal workers are asking for what every worker deserves: fair wages, safe working conditions, and job security. But Canada Post has chosen to drag its feet, and it's creating unnecessary economic chaos instead of coming to the table with a meaningful solution.
O'Neill says the idle postal workers should be busy, especially this time of year, as the strike enters the fourth week.
So if we had no strike right now, we would be overloaded in parcels, letters, cards, everything. And we want to make sure that the communities can receive these letters and packages. We would be really busy right now. And I see that other competitors can't carry the load that's been attached to them. So we need to get back to work so that everyone can have a good Christmas across Canada.
Meanwhile, Purolator and UPS are pausing some shipments as they work through the floods of deliveries resulting from the strike. Purolator says it needs to prioritize critical shipments. Couriers such as Canada's e-shippers are among the companies temporarily barred from shipping with Purolator and UPS. Those companies act as middlemen between smaller e-commerce businesses and large carriers. The CBRM is trying to get the word out to some people about their water and wastewater bills, with mailing bills not an option now because of the Canada Post strike. CBRM spokesperson Jen McQueen speaks to Coast News Director Bobby Nock.
I guess I want to start off by asking what's happening with these water, wastewater bills. Are they normally mailed to people, and because of the postal strike, they can't be this time?
So, exactly. The water bills are typically mailed out, but we don't have the ability to mail these bills to residents at this time. And water bills are mailed out in sections based on what zone people are in. So we put out a Facebook notice to let people know what zones are available to have their water bills ready to them right now.
And can you run down the list, or do you have it handy there? Or?
Absolutely. So it's all of North Sydney and all of Sydney Mines. And then there's certain sections of Grace Bay Reserve Mines, South Burlingame, Whitney Pier, and as well as parts of Balls Creek, Leeches Creek, Upper North Sydney, Georges River, Bredour, Florence, Groves Point, you name it. So it's those areas where there's parts of those areas. We're asking people to either call 311 or email waterbill@cbrm.ns.ca to check to see if your water bill is ready. And they can either email you the bill, or if you go on our Facebook page and you see that your address is included in the map area, you can also come pick it up at the Citizen Service Center here at City Hall at 320 Esplanade Street anytime Monday to Friday between 8:30 and 4:30, and you can get your bill that way as well.
Now, are you going to be using any other ways to try to get the message out to people other than on Facebook? Because, you know, not everyone's on social media. Are you hoping that the word just gets around anyway?
So we're looking at alternate ways to communicate with people at this time. Right now we've posted on Facebook and have done a boosted ad, and then we're working as well with our local media partners to hope to try and get the word out to folks as well on ways that we can make people aware that the new wastewater and water bills are available and can be ready for pickup or email.
Okay, so I guess we can help you out.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
These are part of the new water wastewater bills that started to go out in April. Is that correct? Is that the
So it's the regular water bill as well as the new wastewater bills that just started in April. So what we're just saying is these aren't old bills. These are the ones that are available at this time. So these are the regular bills, regular water bills, but for this billing cycle.
Right, and there are a number of ways that people can get their hands on those bills during the Canada Post strike. So anyway, those options are out there.
Absolutely.
And what's the deadline for paying these bills? Does it vary, or is
it varies based on each individual zone? So we do have different deadlines in these different batches, but some are at the end of December. So we're trying to get the word out there to folks that the bills are available and can be ready for pickup or email, and just to reach out and get those bills.
Right. Okay. And the end of the month is coming fast, especially with Christmas.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for your time. And is there anything else you wanted to add?
No, I think that's all. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks.
Have a good one.
You too.
Bye-bye.
The Sydney Scotiabank branch has some new frustrated clients. The Glace Bay and Waterford branches permanently closed last month. Clients say they did not receive an official explanation other than their account information was being switched to Sydney. These clients resentfully traveled to Sydney.
I would say it cost me a lot of money and gas. Now I got to go back. So there's $20 extra.
Basically, what I'm thinking is that we're just going to add to the lineups by reducing the number of banks in the local area.
I came from Glace Bay to use the Scotiabank machines because they closed them down in Glace Bay and supposedly in Waterford. I'm not sure, but it's just a big hassle.
I just came from New Waterford myself and sitting in the line up there. I was thinking I saw the frustration on people's faces. I can tell you that much in the lineup.
Yeah, I got to drive back. You know, all this just to put $100 and some bucks in the machine, and, you know, when I could have been done 5 minutes down there, it takes me an hour to use a bank machine. They don't even have like a bank machine to use in the bay, you know what I mean? So, oh, it's a big inconvenience, huge.
I came from Glace Bay, and the issue I have is the traffic. You know, there's so much traffic down here, it's hard to get in and out.
Meanwhile, this customer says it's a sign of the times and technologies available for people who don't want to travel.
I don't think it's that big a deal. I think people are in too much of a rush all the time. It's unfortunate that people don't have everything in their community, but with online banking and the way the world has changed, people just have to accept the change and move on, I think.
Coast Radio requested an interview with Scotiabank about possible job losses in the other communities and how the Sydney branch plans to accommodate the added clients. They didn't respond yet, but this client says a Sydney employee gave him an update.
Well, I was asking the lady about it, and she said they're going to make the bank bigger on this end. And they said the cashiers from New Waterford are in here now, some of them. They were pointing them out to me, so showing me to try to take the stress. So we hope it works.
Scotiabank said in an earlier statement, with customer preferences changing and more day-to-day banking being done digitally, we are continuing to evolve how we serve our customers and invest in areas that make it easier for the customers to bank from wherever they are. The recent provincial election had the lowest voter turnout in the province's history. Dialogue's Jacob Postaway talks to Cape Breton University political science professor Tom Urbaniak, who believes there could have been more robust efforts to reach individual voters with information about the election.
What factors do you think led to this low turnout?
There were several factors contributing to this low turnout. The fact that Elections Nova Scotia did not send out voter cards to each individual voter has to be cited as one of the factors in this low voter turnout. Those voter information cards were specific and direct reminders that the election is approaching with specific instructions about how to vote. Now, voters were told to engage in a sort of multi-step process to be able to find where to vote. And on Election Day itself, the system was crashing for Elections Nova Scotia. So that's not good. There will have to be some review and discussion about Elections Nova Scotia's procedures. Yes, there was an exceptional situation here with the looming Canada Post strike, but I think in retrospect, it might have been possible to get those voter information cards to the voters, notwithstanding the likelihood of a Canada Post strike. And if the Canada Post strike had indeed disrupted the voter information cards, I think there could have been a more robust effort to reach individual voters with information about the procedure for the election. But beyond that, there are, I think, other factors. This was a very, very low-key election campaign. It was the quietest election campaign that I think I have witnessed in Nova Scotia. The parties were not as mobilized as usual. The passions were lower than usual. And let's not discount the impact of the mobilization that is done by the parties and the candidates to actually get voters to the polls. So in my own riding of Glace Bay Dominion, only one of the parties even got a flyer into my mailbox, at least. There were very few home visits being done by candidates. The NDP, which had just barely lost in the riding in the 2021 election, did not have any signs up in the riding, and the candidate was invisible. So that actually does have an impact, because the parties themselves have a role in mobilizing voters. Tim Houston's strategy going into this early election campaign, which preempted his own Bill 1, the fixed election date law, was sort of to win the election by default, to present a low-key image that acknowledging that that there are some problems in Nova Scotia, that he's working on them, that he's on the right track, more or less, and that there's really not that much to see here. And he would sort of convey a message of optimism. We're on a roll. We've got mojo. And to the extent that there are any grievances, it's really Justin Trudeau's fault. And that, I think, did play a little bit of a role in indirectly suppressing the vote this time.
Yeah, it seemed like there was a lot of, you know, comparing and sort of linking together the Nova Scotia Liberal Party with the federal Liberals.
And the PCs did that with some success in this campaign. Zach Churchill is a veteran provincial politician. He was elected in 2010 in a by-election. He served in senior ministerial portfolios in the Stephen McNeil government. But he was actually not a household name in Nova Scotia at the start of this election campaign. And that's largely because Stephen McNeil ran such a centralized government in the sense that he was almost a one-man government. He would not give his ministers a lot of profile. He would be seen to be taking all the major decisions himself, even in the portfolios of competent ministerial colleagues like Zach Churchill. So that actually hurt Zach Churchill. He hadn't established his own personality with Nova Scotians. And that created a huge opening for the PCs to run negative advertising, basically portraying Zach Churchill as the junior protege of Justin Trudeau. And that worked among some Nova Scotians.
Yeah, I know one thing they used was there was a photo of Trudeau and Zach Churchill sitting down together, and that photo was pretty much everywhere.
Right. But it's also interesting to note that the PCs adopted a kind of two-pronged strategy, almost like a split personality strategy. So Tim Houston himself usually presented himself as sort of like the friendly patron of Nova Scotia. You know, sometimes he would shoot back at his opponents, but he presented a much more moderate face than, let's say, someone like his federal conservative counterpart, Pierre Poilievre. That wasn't the Tim Houston style. It was a sort of easygoing, friendly, accessible style. While the PC machine, and there was a bit of a communications machine, more than we usually see in Nova Scotia politics, was cranking out press releases or social media posts about not just the other leaders, but about candidates even. So locally, at one point, John White started putting out stuff about Joe Ward, who was running for the Liberals in the neighboring riding. And John White didn't sit down on his own computer and come up with that by himself. That was done by a communications war room for the PC party.
Well, let's talk about, you know, now that the election is over and, you know, it seems like the PCs have what a lot of people are calling a supermajority. Going forward, what's that going to mean for them to have gained so much ground in the legislature?
I hope that it doesn't mean a lot in terms of how the legislature operates. So technically, the supermajority, so having more than two-thirds of the MLAs, would allow the PCs to invoke, I think it's Section 85 of the Rules and Forms of Procedure of the House of Assembly of Nova Scotia, which is to dispense with the existing rules. And so that could affect things like the speaking time that is given to members of the opposition or the representation of the opposition MLAs on the standing committees of the House. If the PCs are wise, they'll avoid the temptation to start changing the rules to basically silence the opposition, because that would be perceived in the public as not fair play. And it would kind of needlessly cost support for the PCs. They're well advised to give the opposition a chance to talk, to give them their place on committee, to not be seen as ramming things through all the time, because that just doesn't fit with the political culture of Nova Scotia.
Right. And speaking of the opposition, the NDP will be the ones to form a small minority opposition. So how are you feeling about that?
Well, it was interesting to note on election night already, after she had finished the usual polite concessions, Claudia Chendra got into a combative mode. And she said, the Liberals didn't hold this government accountable, but we will. And she started already referring to backroom deals and policy failures. So the NDP actually, despite being just a small number of MLAs, nine, seems to be in a bit of a buoyant mood and relishing the opportunity to serve as official opposition. So we will see how that unfolds. I mean, the NDP has some experienced MLAs in its caucus, its small caucus, good speakers. They do have a bit of a research capacity. I've observed this in just watching constantly the House of Assembly. They have MLAs who can make some very effective interventions. The challenge for them is the public doesn't always pay attention to that. And so how can they now broaden the communication to a larger public? And there's a big job to do. They're huge. They need to start now if they're serious about contending for power in the next election. They need to start now developing riding associations in places where they have zero presence, where they had to put in parachuted candidates this time. They need to go on a listening tour and sit in church basements and community halls and just hear what people are saying on the ground in specific communities and start tailoring an election campaign and a platform to be seen as really responding to people's anxieties on the ground. And that includes rural Nova Scotia, where, you know, the NDP is very weak and remained weak during the campaign because they ran a strategic campaign basically focusing on a handful of ridings where they thought they had a great chance of winning.
Right. And as far as the third major party in this election, the Liberals, they were stomped. They completely stomped in this election. So yeah. What do you think were their biggest mistakes, and what do they need to do going forward to rebuild their party?
Yeah, so the Liberals didn't make spectacular mistakes in terms of like candidate recruitment or the leader's speeches or the platform. Like all of these were credible. But they were really sort of weighed down by the Justin Trudeau factor, by hangover from their years in power. They still kind of felt like the incumbents a little bit, whereas people were saying, well, the PCs are only 3 years and a bit into their mandate. Maybe they're making progress on something. Let's give them a chance to continue and see what happens. But the Liberals now, I mean, they've collapsed. So they are building from the ground up. They're going to probably have to be cautious not to give the old establishment of the party too much say, because you know part of that old establishment contributed to this collapse. So they've got to have a thinkers conference, just come up with some fresh ideas and fresh faces, and they're realistically they're probably in a two election cycle here. You know, thinking about the next 8 years rather than just the next four. But they will have to start right away. They still are an official party in the legislature. There's a low bar in Nova Scotia, just two seats. And they met the 10% threshold, of course. Actually, got a little bit more of the popular vote than the NDP did, but their vote was not efficiently distributed. And they ran in all of the ridings. So they are an official party. There will be a lot of focus on Derek Mombriquette now. Will he step forward maybe to be the leader of the Liberal Party? Because their preference would probably be to draw on this tiny caucus rather than recruit someone from outside who would have to be paid a salary and might be distracted by other responsibilities if they can't pay a decent salary to this person who's sitting outside the house. So the Liberals are in for a long haul. I mean, I think they eventually will reemerge. I mean, the brand is deeply damaged right now, but it is such an enduring brand in Nova Scotia and Canada that it would be hard to imagine the Liberals disappearing from the Nova Scotia landscape.
Well, thanks so much for chatting with me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Jacob.
All right, you have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Some children on the north side are not asking for the latest PlayStation or smartphone this Christmas. In fact, they don't even expect toys because of the high cost of presents. Leaders at the J Street Youth Center in Sydney Mines and North Sydney's Clifford Street Youth Center say they're trying to help struggling families make ends meet. A typical wish list for children there has toothpaste, bedding, food, and blankets. North Sydney's Brandy Burke says they aren't asking for much.
They want bedding, pillows, toothbrushes, hairbrushes, just basic, run-of-the-mill life. Money's tighter any time of the year, don't get me wrong. Christmas brings it down a lot harder than normal. So if it's to have meal on the table or to get toys for your kids, you're going to pick a meal on the table, unfortunately, right? So the kids are probably just thinking, well, if I can get this, then it'd be some money we could save. We could do a movie night or something.
She says it's unsettling when the children ask for the unusual Christmas presents.
That one's a really harsh one, I guess you want to say. I'm really soft-hearted. So when I hear what the kids are asking for, I write it down, and then I have to take a few seconds and go in the office, rather shed a tear or just screech in my own head, just because to me it's not realistic. Like, they should be asking for toys instead of, like, personal items, right?
Brandy says they are dealing with a downward trend from last year.
It gotten a lot worse this year. Last year we had a kid ask for Rice Krispies. One kid. This year it's like they're wanting blankets and pillows and slippers, like essential use that you would have, and you don't got that. So it's kind of like a really weird spot to be in, to know that these kids are wanting this stuff instead of fun toys to play with, right? So yeah.
She says they notice how important the Clifford Street Youth Center's services are, especially in the summer and the winter.
We see a lot more kids during December, and our summertime, we see a lot of kids. Like, we could be at 80 to 90 per center, roughly, because they just pop in, and if they find out that, hey, we're going on a field trip, then kids that haven't been on a field trip or don't have an access to a vehicle or to play with their friends or their peers, they're like, okay, well, I can go with a youth center and I'm going to be looked after. And yeah, so they want to come with us. So yeah, our numbers go up higher those two times.
Brandy says even though the gift requests are simple, they still take pride in what they own.
Our kids are not greedy by all means. They're just looking for stuff they want. Yes, it's not like a Barbie doll or PlayStation games. They just want something for themselves, not to share with anybody else, but themselves in their health and hygiene and just keeping up with everyday kids at school, right?
Lead volunteer Paul Ratchford says he was inspired to be involved after hearing a kid talk about a simple vegetable like an exotic meal, and he talks about how he helped to get the center started a few years ago.
So in 2008, almost 17 years ago, the youth center was opened, not as a youth center, but as a community meeting space through the Association for Safer Cape Breton Communities, which had mandated that we go to four communities and do door knocks. So as a police officer at that time, I went to virtually every house in North Sydney and asked folks what they wanted to see. And every town I went to, New Waterford, Glace Bay, North Sydney, and City Mines, they all said more things for kids. That didn't necessarily happen, but what it did lead us to is the skateboard park you see now, the pool reopening, and the AmeriCenter. Because the groups used to meet here to discuss it. The Cancer Society used to meet here. Anyway, how we got kids here, and that's the unusual story, and I'm sorry if I'm a little long-winded, you can cut me off. What happened with our kids is this center was open up for adults. So if you had to come here for a meeting for whatever group you belong to, you could. We give you the space. There was nothing in it, nothing for children. But I had one young fella who lived in the area, and I used to routinely arrest his parents. And every time I went in to arrest his parents, he wisely would take his sibling outside while we were rolling around on the ground trying to arrest the parents. Anyway, kid was really smart, really good. The family had its issues, but you know they did what they could for their children at the time. Anyway, when I opened the office here, he said, "I see you got computers in there." And I said, "Well, yeah, we have some computers. They don't work." I said, "Why?" This is 2008 or 2009 now. And I said, "Well, they're Y2K computers." I said, "They're a decade old. They don't work the way the internet, because we were before internet or just starting with internet then, as you know." And they didn't understand all that. Anyway, we brought out retired Alliant and Bell people to try and get them to work. Couldn't get them to work. We did everything in our power. Nothing would happen. So finally, I put him off. I said, "Look, if you can get those computers to work, I'll let you in to use them." I said, "Why do you want to use them?" He said, "Well, it's like this." He said, "I have to babysit my sibling, and I can't go to the library to do homework because I'm not allowed to take a sibling, and I only get 15 minutes at a time at the library. So I can't do my homework because we don't have internet, and I don't even have a computer at home." I said, "Fair enough." So anyway, you can figure, he went in 15 minutes later. He had 3 out of 4 working. And I said, "How the hell did you do that?" He said, "Well, I'm used to working with junk." And so I said, "Well, made a deal, come on in." So I brought a sibling in with him. He said, "Can I bring a couple other kids in?" So they came in, and I had a volunteer here. And one day I came in with a bag of apples, and I put it down, and the kids attacked the apples. They were starving to begin with, and they loved apples. So I got another bag, and they ate that. So then it became an observation, because I knew how some of our kids were living. And it's not just kids from the immediate area. It's kids from all over. They told 2 friends from school, and we'd get, you know, 50 to 150 kids a day through the doors. They'd come for a meal, or they'd come in for 5 minutes. Graduating onwards, we decided to do a grading day that June, and I told my boss, "I need his credit card. I'm going to buy $200 worth of food." I bought about 240 hot dogs, several watermelons, carrots, tomatoes, lettuce, apples, oranges, all that stuff. And he said, "What the hell are you buying?" I said, "Well, no offense," I said, "but our kids don't see that." I said, "You can buy 2 liters of milk for 88 cents. You can buy a big bag of chips for 88 cents. That's what our kids eat. They want milk. They want everything other kids wouldn't want, these kids want, because they would never see it." One of our kids, as a matter of fact, we had a meeting here one time, and we had a big tray up, and I used to take the trays after the meeting, because if the meeting was going on, they couldn't let the kids in. One of the kids came in. I said, "Help yourself, buddy." And he was just chewing down. He's grabbing this stuff, and he's chewing and chewing and eating. He said, "Man, this is the best stuff ever," as only kids can say. And he said, "What is this?" I said, "Have you never seen that before?" He said, "No." He's 8 years old. It was celery. He's never seen celery. I said, so that makes you start to wonder what our kids didn't see. So then I started paying attention to the volunteers and student placements and CBU and NSCC students that came here to follow. All were part of that study. And Brandy, who is here with us today, her 2 daughters came here after a few years when we were open, and she moved into the area. And so that's what we did. It was observing to see what kids need on the very front line. So that's where we are. And that was the original foundation. We've got thousands of stories and eye-opening events, and they still occur even after 16 years, where I just get a surprise, say, I didn't think of that. Simple things like taking one of our kids to the restaurant, particularly post-COVID, because you kind of forget people were out of school for 3 years. You know, I took a couple of our kids in, and you have a 15 or 16 or 17-year-old, they've never been to a restaurant. They've been to a McDonald's, but never to a restaurant that had a menu, or formal dining, or not even formal for that matter, just play settings. Because, of course, 3 or 4 years of COVID also have impacted what people learned or didn't get to learn. So we work really hard at that. We were open during COVID when we were legally allowed to be, and we provided food, and we still continue to provide food. which is one of our number one issues, food security issues. But we also provide experiences. A lot of our kids don't have an opportunity. A lot of our kids get car sick because they don't have cars. Not all, but lots. If you live close to school, you don't have to take a bus. So they have motion sickness issues. And so those are the little things you don't think of. We've had people volunteer to say, look, we're going to give you free passes for our kids to a summer camp. And then they gave us a list that, well, you need 7 t-shirts, 7 underwear, 2 sneakers. I said, well, the entire family might have that, but not one kid. And that's when the camps realized that it's a bigger issue than what you just donate. There's a whole lot of other issues. Like even when we get food at Christmas, we're going to donate a turkey. I said, well, it's pretty hard to, I said, you'll have to get an aluminum roaster. What do you mean? I said, well, a lot of our families, not all, but a lot of our families will only have one pot and one pan. They certainly don't have a roaster. They don't have the ability to cook all that food. Even if they got it, they couldn't cook it. I said, so what we're looking at is the impacts that people face. And it doesn't have to be necessarily poverty. It could be a fire in the household, families separating and having to start over, young folks that are starting out fresh in life and the things they have to, the challenges they come to. I mean, if you've ever looked around a kitchen and you look at the utensils that are there, there's a few hundred dollars worth of spatulas and flippers and knives and strange things like that that nobody ever thinks of when they go out on their own. So we help people that way. We get dryers for people because housing will assist with a washer but not a dryer. We move furniture for folks. We get clothes all the time. And, of course, in concert with Swartz's and, I guess, Lindsay's this year, we'll be getting more coats again. We give out coats every Christmas, gloves. We do road trips, experiential exposure. And our list is long.
Rochford says other organizers like Victoria McNevin of the Sydney Mine Center go beyond the call of duty and they aren't motivated by salaries.
For me personally, I grew up under the poverty line with a single parent. So I can relate a lot to our youth's struggles and giving back to them and helping them in ways I wish I had is definitely a big thing for me. It's what makes me get up every day.
Victoria says the young clients in Sydney Mines are also keeping it very simple this year, and she says it's unfortunate because it's a time for celebration.
Yeah, items this year are things, as Brandy had mentioned, coats, boots, blankets, pillows, personal hygiene supplies. It's things that you'd never expect kids to actually ask for. It's quite heartbreaking to hear because Christmas and kids, you think of toys, you think of excitement, not the fact that a kid needs a winter coat or mittens.
Victoria adds all donations are welcomed from the community as well. Your time is very valuable too.
Any bit of help, if you even want to come and volunteer for the day, the extra hands are great. If you could donate, that's wonderful help too. Spread the word about us. Yeah. And Merry Christmas.
Next, the late, great Ann Terry, a name familiar to many. She lit up the airwaves with her unique golden voice and could paint 1,000 pictures with just a few words. She was known as the First Lady of Cape Breton.
Claude Lise Gagnon talks about Quebec at Christmas, which of course is a very joyous time, I'm sure. But she says, what comes to mind as I conjure up the winters of my childhood is the silence. A silence that was almost complete, except for the sound of the church bells, the tinkling bells of the elegant sleighs called carrioles, and the shouts of children playing in the schoolyard. And I remember how dazzling white everything was 40 years ago. I was born, she said, in Oka, a little village about 50 kilometers west of Montreal. And with the arrival of the first snowstorms at the end of November or the beginning of December, the roads and the highways were always closed, and you could only get around on foot or by sleigh. Cars stayed tucked away in their garages, and to travel any distance at all, you had to take the train. But there wasn't a station at Oka. The train only stopped at Como on the other side of the lake. And when the lake was frozen, the mail and any visitors to our town were transported over the ice. You know, she said, I think about those times occasionally. But the winter that comes to my mind most often is the winter of 1939, when I was 8 years old. Come on, you will be tempted to say, what can you recall of that time? Ah, she said, but when you're 8 years old, important events and people do make a deep impression. They stay in the back of your mind for the rest of your life. And then, too, there are the smells and the pictures and the songs that never cease to follow you. That Christmas, she said, my father was expecting the visit of an important Russian agronomist. During the past 10 years, because the climatic conditions of the two countries are similar, my father and this Russian had been corresponding with each other, discussing their research and various methods of cultivation. Because, you see, my father taught at the local agricultural college, 5 kilometers from Oka. Everything had been prepared for our guest, and in the small wine cellar, carefully put down, were the bottles of my father's favorite things like Bordeaux and Burgundies and Anjou Rosé, and there was one called the Old Bell, translated, the Chaser, potent enough to bring tears to the eyes of a seasoned sailor. And then in the freezer were perch and lake pike and pheasants and ducks and a fine plump turkey ready for stuffing and roasts tied up with white string. And for desserts, there were plenty of them, including donuts and meringues and date squares and cream whipped smoother than fine silk and almond tarts. And in the living room stood the Christmas tree, a sparkling, sweet-smelling fir that stretched as high as the ceiling. Cones from our spruce trees, wreathed with red ribbons, hung above the mirrors. In truth, as far as I was concerned, winter began at the Christmas holidays. Before that was merely the end of an old, depressing season. Then on December 24th, 1939, at 3 p.m., Father hired a neighbor's horses to go and meet the important Russian at the train. The horses were 2 fine, black-coated animals, frisky on an outward run and veritable coursers on their way back to the stables. They were harnessed to a black sled where we kept warm under buffalo furs. From the platform of the little station, I spotted the locomotive and its plume of white smoke approaching in the distance, and the first passenger to alight was the fair-bearded Russian who bewitched me instantly. He was tall and powerfully built, wearing an extraordinary sable coat of a kind that I had never seen, and a hat of the same fur after the Cossack style. And with a smile stretching from ear to ear, he opened his arms to my father, told him he had come from Moscow with only vodka to inspire him, whisked me up off the ground, gave a smart tap to the neck of the right-hand horse, climbed into the sleigh, and away we went at a gallop. How comfortable I was, snuggled between the 2 men in their wildcat and sable coats. How I loved that winter, she said. Father Christmas, the holidays, the visit, the snow. I would sometimes hear grown-ups complain that winter never ended and was terribly harsh. For me, she said, it was a source of wonderment. Our house in the heart of the village was lighted completely when we arrived. When the Russian saw my mother, smiling, beautiful, dressed in very soft blue, I could sense he would have been happy to take her in his arms in the way he had approached father, but he bowed to her in a very princely fashion and with deep rumbling A sounds and heavily trilled R's. He recited in French what were apparently some very well-tuned compliments. That night, as we leisurely ate the appetizing evening meal, we explained to the tall foreigner from Russia that on Christmas Eve we had a special tradition, Midnight Mass, which in reality consisted of 3 masses. The first, solemn and rather long, was sung in Latin and was celebrated by 3 priests wearing chasubles of gold cloth. The second was shorter, with a choir throwing itself into the Christmas carols that were thoroughly familiar to everyone in the church. And the last Mass was dispatched at a quick, lively pace, the Christ child now having been born and everybody being in a hurry to get back home. Then the presents were placed at the foot of the tree, and finally came the midnight feast, which could and did last until dawn. Although he was Russian Orthodox, our visitor was anxious to accompany us to the Catholic Church, where Denny Arbour, who had the finest voice in the village and was going to become an opera singer, opened the service with the famous O Holy Night. And his sister, Marie-Ange, was at the organ. And the choir was made up of local people, and some of them had very good voices. But when it was the turn of the organist, the lovely Marie-Ange, with her luxurious flowing hair and soft blue eyes, to raise her heavenly voice in silent night, a hushed rapture descended upon us. In short, it was one of the finest midnight masses ever. We still talk about it. Well, the party that followed was a great success, too. The Gaspé salmon, the black duck from the lake, the Lac Saint-Pierre teal, the Lac Saint-Jean meat pie, the famous Oka cheese claimed their moment of attention before being forgotten in favor of apple tarts and homemade sugar pies. And all this was washed down with white and red wine to such good effect that with the cognac came the songs of the vast steppes of Russia, and it lasted for 2 hours. And of course there were presents. And in his suitcases, in addition to vodka and Black Sea caviar and an icon for mother and a balalaika for father and a lacquered jewel case for me and some painted eggs, the big Russian had also brought a number of books, some by Tolstoy and by Chekhov. There was no afternoon in the year when the streets in our town were quieter than on Christmas Day. Everyone was asleep, except for the children who were sent off to play in the snowbanks. I suggested that our guests should come and see the nearby lake where we skated, a favorite winter pastime. I made a point of bringing out the red wooden sleigh that my father had built so that he could take me along, bundled up in a blanket. The big Russian understood right away when he saw the sleigh at the door, and with a laugh he harnessed himself to it, and we headed for the lake. And he brought me some chocolates in the variety store on the way and walked a long distance over the ice, then made a wide detour and returned home through the forest of fir trees. And he told me that he had a little girl like me, a dog like mine, and a little boy. And he often walked in his country, he said, beside a river called Oka, just like here. I was very proud. We are related, I told myself. This stranger from such a faraway land made such a big hit with my friends. And what a funny coat he had, they said. And when he went out for a stroll, he never went alone. A whole crowd of lively little children would go along with him. And when he left, we kept something of him, a Russian song he had taught us called Black Eyes. On the morning of New Year's Day, when the carriole took all four of us to catch the train, he to return to Russia, we to go and celebrate New Year's at my grandparents', the little boys and girls who had so often touched the Russian's coat as if it were a talisman were all there to see him off. And he squeezed several little hands, and he kissed many rosy cheeks, and he took me on his lap. The goodbyes were said at Montreal. They were affectionate, as always happens when people have taken a liking to each other, and everybody promised to meet again. In my grandparents' house, there were 40 of us at two tables, and how we talked. As soon as the desserts had disappeared, the men sat around one side, the women on the other. There was a ceaseless interchange of stories, political opinions, bits of news, and so on. The evening ended with dancing and singing for the grown-ups, while we had our own party by the light of the oil lamp and pretended to be asleep when a footstep was heard on the stairs. And eventually everybody did fall asleep, late and happy. True, that night I had heard sinister words. War, René and the army overseas, fighting going on. But when one is 8 years old... Well, it seems that there is more to share, but it will have to be for another time. We've shared music, we've shared memories, we've shared reflections of other people's Christmases, and we've looked a little at our own, and maybe that's what it's all about. A time for stories and nostalgia and laughter and music and quietness and fireplaces and mellow lights and special people. Maybe you're getting ready to have your Christmas dinner. Maybe you've already had your Christmas dinner, and this is the quiet time before the doorbell rings and the laughter begins. Maybe you're alone. No, you're not alone. We're together.
Longtime Sydney resident Albert Miles tells a story of Christmas on a fishing dragger from years ago. Many people know Albert from working around downtown Sydney, including Spinner's Menswear and Ed's Bookstore. From Book 10 of Cape Breton's Christmas by Breton Books, this is Paul McDougall.
I was the galley cook on the fishing dragger, Cape Norman, under Captain Gerald Vallis, working for National Sea Products, leaving Lewisburg to fish the Grand Banks off Newfoundland for 10 days at a go, and to return with a hold full of cod, haddock, halibut, and other fish. Before we left Lewisburg, I would place an $8,000 grocery order in one of the stores in town, enough to do us for the whole 10 days. I had a big galley where I fixed the meals for the crew. I had a nice-sized room with a nice-sized bunk off the galley. We had a good bunch of crew, and if I wasn't in the galley cooking, I'd be out on deck helping the crews to haul in the net, gut the fish, and put the catch down in the hole and ice them off. The dragger had one big net with two big wooden doors at the front with a lead pipe under the doors to belly the net down to the floor of the ocean. There were also rollers on the bottom of the net. After 2 hours of dragging the net across the ocean bottom, we would haul it up on deck and open it to release the catch. The gear went back over the side. Then, for 2 hours, all the crew would gut the fish, ice off the catch, and put it down in the hole. We never celebrated Christmas on the dragger. There was no Christmas gear on board. Christmas started when we hit the dock. Then we would buy our presents before we headed home. This one December, I remember it being so stormy, high winds, high waves. The dragger would climb a tall wave and suddenly drop over the top so you could see the propellers turning above the water. And coming down the slope of the wave, the dragger would pull over and tip to one side. Despite all that, we made it back to Lewisburg for Christmas. I remember seeing all the colors of the Christmas lights in the windows of the houses around Lewisburg Harbor. I had already cleared and cleaned the galley and stowed all my pots and pans. The rest of the crew cleared up outside, so everything was put away before we reached the dock. All the crew hurried home for Christmas with their families, some of them as far away as Newfoundland. A lot of them hurried off to get drunk. I would get a taxi to North Sydney and enjoy a big turkey dinner with my sister Kathleen, or Kay as we all called her, and her two girls and three boys. I had a big family all over the place. As for presents, one of the things I gave was fresh cod, haddock, and halibut steaks. Everybody loves eating fish over the holidays. After the new year, I would get another big grocery order and fill my galley with enough food for 10 days out on the ocean. The crew returned from their holiday, and the Cape Norman set out from Lewisburg to the Grand Banks for another 10 days of fishing.
That's all for Dialogue this week. If you have an idea for a segment on the show, contact the newsroom at news@costaradio.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.